WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Pat Barker, is best known for her novel Regeneration, which is set in the First World War and is based on the relationship between poet Siegfried Sassoon when he was a soldier and British Army psychologist William Rivers. It was part of a trilogy set in the First World War. Although Barker's new novel, Another World, is set in the present, the memory of the war is a constant presence. The story revolves around a newly married couple. It's a second marriage for each of them. They each have a child from a previous marriage in addition to the baby they've just had together. The husband's grandfather, Geordie, is 101 years old and is dying of cancer. He's one of the last survivors of World War I, and because he is one of the few people left with first-person memories of the war, he is now seen as quite extraordinary. The novel is concerned with the impact of war memories on soldiers and how those memories change over the years. I asked Barker why she's so interested in that.
I think possibly family reasons, though I'm always a little doubtful when authors come up with, you know, neat autobiographical reasons for the, you know, for why they write the books they do. But the fact is that my grandfather fought in the First World War. He didn't, unlike Geordie, the character in my book, talk about it a great deal until immediately before he died. But I think that is possibly the source of my interest. The source of my interest in the different ways in which wars are remembered, I think, derives from something I read about the Second World War, about the Blitz in this country, where there is a very powerful myth of how brave people were, how cheerful they were, how they all went down into the shelters singing and so on. And in fact, what actually happened in the worst incidents, there was looting, there was bombing, there were people wandering around in shock, not knowing who they were. You could argue, I think, that what people remember about a war is what the national legend permits them to remember. And the reason I find Geordie fascinating, actually, is that he does, to a very great extent, maintain his own memories in a very clean form. He's actually quite resistant to having the passing changes in the way in which his war experience is regarded foisted onto him as if they were his real experience. There is in Geordie a bedrock identity, strength of identity, which won't permit his experience to be distorted by other people.
You said that your grandfather didn't really talk about World War I with his family until shortly before his death. What kind of stories did he start talking about shortly before he died?
We tell the story of his bayonet wound. He had a bayonet wound exactly like Geordie, and of how he survived, in fact, because as the bayonet was stuck into him, the person standing next to him shot the man who had just bayoneted him, so it wasn't twisted and withdrawn, as it, which is the sort of sequence of events with a bayonet wound. And for how he lay in outdoors for 2 or 3 days before the wounded could be recovered, and actually ended up with maggots in the wound. So he did have traumatic memories. And at the end of his life, he actually believed, as Geordie also does, that the bayonet wound was killing him. He actually died of cancer, but he attributed the symptoms of his cancer to this very old wound. And I don't think that was pure ignorance. I think that was that he almost needed to think that he was going to die as his comrades had died. I think it was a classic case of somebody who survived and felt guilty, sort of almost arranging for himself to expiate the guilt of having survived.
Where was your grandfather during World War I, and what did he do?
He was an ordinary soldier, and he was in France, apart from the time when he was recovering from his bayonet wound in this country. I have to say, by the way, that my grandfather was nothing like Geordie. I mean, I don't know where Geordie as a character comes from, but he does share that particular circumstances of the wound, which when I was a little girl, of course, was a very striking feature of family life, because my grandfather would get undressed in front of the sink, and I would see this wound and ask him what it was.
Was it really big?
It was messy rather than... Yes, it was messy and it was deep because he had put on a lot of weight with the passing years and there was a sort of little tunnel that you could stick your finger into. I did do that, yes. I was a very normal little girl, I would like to add.
Did that seem grotesque and scary to you?
No, it seemed entirely normal. It's a scene I would not like to try to write because I think it would come across as appallingly sentimental. But at the time, when I was, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old, it just seemed an entirely normal thing to do.
In your novel, the grandfather's last words as he's dying is, "I am in hell." And the present tense of that statement really terrifies his grandson. What do you think he was reliving when he said, "I am in hell"?
I think he was reliving the guilt of having... the false guilt, I think, of not having perhaps done enough to save his brother, who died in the war and to whom his feelings had always been very ambivalent. It's the old problem of if people die in terribly painful circumstances, or they die when their minds are temporarily disturbed, what they say in these states is likely to linger on very forcefully in the minds of the people who have loved them and lost them. But it is, of course, only a few sentences in an entire long lifetime. And one of the challenges, I suppose, of grieving is to get beyond those final words and recover a sense of the person as they were before the final illness. And certainly before the final illness, Geordie was a life force. He was not somebody who was giving way to the nightmares of the past.
Sounds like you're speaking from experience here.
I lost my mother recently, and my mother, well, 3 weeks ago, and my mother's final words were, "You are taking away my life, my sanity, and I want it back. You've taken away my sanity, you've taken away my freedom, I want it back." And this was a transitory episode of confusion caused by the drugs she was on. So, like Nick in a way, but after I wrote the book, I am faced with now with that problem of getting beyond the final few hours of my mother's life and trying to recapture the sense of the woman she once was.
Did having already written that book and thinking it through in terms of fiction help you at all in dealing with the reality?
It's happened to me before. I don't think it helps. I think it's almost frightening. I read something in a novel by A.L. Kennedy recently in which she points out that surprisingly often it's not so much that you base your fiction on life, it's that you write the fiction and then life supplies the experience to you. It's almost as if your imagination chooses what you write about, but in some very mysterious way, it also chooses what will happen to you.
In your new novel, Another World, you know, not only is the grandfather thinking about his experiences in World War I when the men of different nations were killing each other, there's a lot of family trouble on the home front in the younger couple that is raising their children. And, I mean, people are very jealous of each other and very resentful of each other in this family, almost murderously so. And so you have this parallel that you're drawing between the way that nations kill each other and the way even people in a family where you're supposed to be very close and love each other, even there's, like, intense hatred.
Yes, I'm glad you used the words the home front, because it almost is like that. There's a preoccupation, I think, with conflict and the ways in which conflict is resolved or not resolved. And I do think there are genuine parallels to be drawn between the experiences of warring individuals and the experiences of warring nations.
Do you feel that's just the natural state we live in, that people hate each other? You know, people are always wondering, why do people kill each other in war? Why can't we all get along? I mean, do you just think this is the human condition? People often really hate each other, even when they're family.
Yes, I think the human condition is inevitably one of fairly frequent conflict. What I'm interested in really is the ways in which some people in some situations are able to resolve that conflict amicably and even creatively, in the sense that something better happens than would have happened if there had been no conflict, and why other people in other situations resolve it by violence and by nothing but violence, and something worse happens than if the conflict had never taken place. It sounds as if, isn't it? It sounds a little bit too grim, I think, the way we're talking, because I'm also fundamentally, I think, more than interested in conflict and violence, I'm interested in moments of human creativity in which people transcend these circumstances, which I think they do very frequently.
My guest is Pat Barker. Her new novel is called Another World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Pat Barker is my guest. Her new novel is called Another World. I want to ask you a little bit about your own life. I know that you were brought up by your grandparents. Your mother was unmarried when she had you, and you never knew who your father was. And you and your mother lived with your grandparents, I believe, till you were about seven, and then your mother remarried and moved out, leaving you behind with your grandparents. I'm wondering how, if you could compare for us, because I think you get these kinds of issues in your fiction, I wonder if you could compare for us how you felt about your mother moving out and leaving you when you were a child, compared to how you would interpret that now.
I think at the time I was completely devastated, perhaps to an unusual extent, since I was, after all, living with my grandparents, whom I had lived with from birth. But I did love my mother very much. And although I went on seeing her, of course, I went on seeing her at perhaps 3 or 4 month or 5 or 6 month intervals. And that isn't really enough for a child of seven. The way I feel about it now is that actually not going with her to her new life was possibly one of the best things that ever happened to me, because the family she married into, my stepfather basically had been married before. He had two children. His wife had died, and those two children had been brought up in foster homes. And he and the boy in particular had a very violent relationship. There were such incidents as, you know, deliberate burning on a grate, or beating with the buckle end of a belt, or getting the boy on the floor and kicking him. It was, in that sense, a violent home, which my mother did her best to manage and turn into a loving home. But I think on balance, I was very well out of it.
Did your mother have children with her husband?
Yes, she did. She also had a boy and a girl.
Did you feel any connection to them, to the children?
I think particularly perhaps to my sister, who was nobody's favourite, as it were. So I decided she would be my favourite when she was a little girl. There was a gap of 10 years between us, so it was. And I saw her only infrequently, but when I did, I certainly got on with her.
In your novel, there are instances of siblings being very violent to each other, particularly siblings being violent toward step-siblings.
Yes.
And I was wondering if that kind of connected to memories or fears from your childhood.
It was certainly a very complex family, and there was, as I say, a lot of violence, but the violence in the family I was involved with came mainly from the father to his own son. That was the That was the main conflict that was in the house, and went on being like that. The boy got into trouble with the police. He was. We always seemed to be visiting one prison or another, and that went on until he separated himself from the family altogether. So yes, I think the level of tension perhaps is there. I would say the violence is far, far greater than it is in Another World. But it's a different kind of violence. The tension in the real family was very different from the tensions in the fictional family. I was not aware of drawing on it directly, though I'm sure that unconsciously I was doing so.
From what I've read, your mother, when she was pregnant with you, felt unprepared to be a mother and didn't want to be a mother yet.
She was very ashamed. It's very difficult for us in our generation to capture the sense of shame that women felt who were pregnant outside marriage in that day. And the shame for her was intensified because this was a wartime relationship. She was on the rebound from a man she had loved very deeply who had just been killed. And I don't think there was any actual relationship, you see. And that was something that she found impossible ever to deal with. Almost to the point where at times she would pretend I was her sister, and things like that, a sort of total denial, really, of my existence.
Is it possible as an adult to feel empathy for what your mother went through, even though at the time it meant rejecting you?
I think it is very possible to feel empathy, and there are specific little stories about the family. When, for example, I was being christened during the war, my godmother refused to carry me, and my step-grandfather, the one with the bayonet wound, carried me instead. But I'm very much aware, as a woman who's also now, of course, brought up children, of how deeply hurt my mother must have been at her child being rejected in that way. Because whatever the circumstances are, you've got a newborn baby, you think it's beautiful, you want everybody else to agree that it's marvellous. And in her situation, that was just not possible. I'm left with a deep sense, I think, of how cruel the world was to women like my mother and how much damage was done.
You know, even in your new novel, you give the mother, in the novel, very conflicted feelings about her family. You know, she loves her children. On the other hand, she feels very oppressed by all the responsibilities of being married and having the children. Yeah,
a lot of women have found Fran a sort of not sympathetic character. They think she's letting down the side because she doesn't have a brilliant career and an immaculate home and, you know, doing creative things with the children in her spare time. But I think there are a lot of women like Fran. I think she's quite inundated by all the conflicting demands of being pregnant, having a toddler, having a stepdaughter whom she can't get on with, and her own son is usually sort of showing her up, as she feels, sort of casting doubts on her ability to be a good mother. And she isn't a positive image of womanhood, but then we can't all be positive images of womanhood all the time.
I want to go back to something we were talking about a little earlier, and this is your grandfather. You had said that your grandfather's memories of the war seemed to surface when he was approaching death, and that was the time, as he got closer to death, that's when he actually started talking about his war memories in the family. And I'm wondering why you think that was so, that after he reached a certain age, that's when he started talking with you, for instance, about the war.
Perhaps so. In the course of a lifetime, you develop ways of dealing with traumatic experiences, of putting them in their place, as it were, and that as your mind loses some of its resilience with in extreme old age, the methods of dealing with the trauma decay, and you find the trauma rising to the surface again, in almost in its old form, and with its old ferocity. He's not the only person I've known of whom it was true that incidents from a combat experience, which was have been long gone and long apparently come to terms with, come back in old age. My husband's father reverted in his mind to the death of his brother in World War One at the end of his life, having never referred to it, you know, in all the years in between.
When you were doing your research for your World War One novels, did you find yourself being astounded as you came to understand what it was that your grandfather must have experienced, which you never would have fully understood when you were young and living with him?
Yes, I did. And I've also had the experience since publishing the Regeneration trilogy of people writing to me and thanking me because they feel for the first time that they understand their fathers or their grandfathers. In particular, one woman quite recently wrote and said that she never understood why her A grandfather who brought her up had been such an unpleasant, such a violent man, and she felt that she now did understand, and because she understood, she was also able to form some kind of relationship with the man he had been in 1914 when he volunteered. And he had been a very happy-go-lucky, very humorous man who wrote poetry, and off he went to war, and the man who came back and brought her up was a fundamentally different person. So just now and again, you do get a glimpse that sometimes a book has changed somebody's life. Perhaps not changed the life itself, but has changed the way somebody is able to understand their life. And that's a rare moment, but it beats all the good reviews in the world.
Pat Barker, her new novel is called Another World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.